All right, so I'm delighted to be here and sitting with all of you this evening. You may have seen an announcement, or if you missed it, I'll say that this title of this series, as I sent it to Donna a while ago, was Comma and the End of Comma. And so we're going to talk about this topic of comma. That's the Pali word, or karma. You may have heard that one, the Sanskrit word, for a couple of sessions. And it's worth exploring in a number of ways. I'll say a little bit more. We'll be unfolding it slowly since we have time. I can't guarantee that I'll be consistent about whether I say comma or karma. So comma is the correct word for our tradition, but karma is the one that we've maybe heard more often. So just know that they're the same thing. The Buddha taught quite frequently about this topic in the early texts. And sometimes it's actually taught in all the Buddhist traditions, but sometimes the language that's used is a little bit different in the later traditions. So I'll be speaking mostly from the framework of early Buddhist teachings, just so you know. So why would we want to know about this somewhat obscure, seemingly, heady sounding topic? Don't worry, we won't make it heady. But there's a number of reasons, actually, why this is extremely relevant. The first being that we all want to know how to live well, how to live with more ease, more peace, more happiness in some way, with well-being and less struggle and less uncertainty. At least I think I'm pretty sure about saying that. And actually, these teachings help us get clear on what we can actually do in our day-to-day life to support that, to make that easier. So, but we also have to do that in a way that isn't superficial, that isn't kind of a glossing over or a pushing aside of what's going on. But these teachings on karma or kama can really help us to understand which actions are effective and which ones are not for bringing about well-being. So there are going to be some ideas to absorb here or to think about, but I'll try to keep it practical, and I encourage practical questions also as we're going along. And then also understanding and living by these ideas about comma is a form of right view, of wise view, which is the first step on the Eightfold Path. So if you feel that you're on a dharmic path or you want to practice the Buddhist teachings, it's really important to have some understanding of karma as the foundational wise view that we hold as we go along our path. And then finally, understanding karma is protective. So it's a way that we can do less harm for ourselves and for others. So that means it's really quite compassionate and loving to know something about karma and how it operates in order that we can express our care and our non-harming in the way that we live in the world. So this word karma, comma, it actually literally means very simply action. It comes from the Pali word karoti, which is a very common word that means to do. It's literally as common as the word do in English. Everybody would know the word that when the Buddha was teaching it. And comma or karma just means action. So maybe a more playful title for this series could be, what are we doing? What are we doing? Sometimes we don't know. So I want to say a little bit more about this idea of action, though, because for us that sounds, I don't know if it has quite the same meaning that it would for somebody in ancient India. So philosophers of the time in ancient India had to have an opinion or a theory of action, as it was called, kind of in the same way that if you're going to be a philosopher or a thinker or even a religious person worth your salt, you should have an opinion in our society on free will. Like, it's that foundational. Like, if you don't have an opinion on that, you sort of wouldn't be taken seriously in the philosophical world, or maybe an idea in religion about God here in the West. So in the same way, in ancient India, you really had to have an idea about action. How is action effective? What are the results of it? That kind of thing. So I hope that gives you a sense of its import, its weight, to have an understanding of karma or theory of karma. So the way that Buddha taught karma was not the same as maybe the other thinkers and teachers of his time. So there were these different theories of action that people had. So I want to say a little bit about other ideas about action that are named that contrast with the Buddha's teachings. And then we'll spend most of our time unfolding what the Buddha talked about. So there are teachings within Buddhism that talk about other people's ideas about how action works and how effective it is. So I'll just name a few of them that are kind of interesting, because we may subtly carry some of these views. We don't automatically have a complete understanding of how what we do impacts the world and ourselves in a correct way. So here's one of the ones that the Buddha named as not being a good idea. Whatever this person experiences, so whatever I experience, whether pleasure, pain, or neither pain nor pleasure, all that is caused by what was done in the past. This is a view or a theory about how action works. So everything that happens to you, is it all determined by something that happened previously? If you say yes, that's not in line with the Buddhist teachings. It's a deterministic view. So the Buddha's objection to this was, why would you be motivated to practice? If everything's all, this is like determinism. Why would you think that it mattered what you did if you couldn't really change anything that was already unfolding? So folding in the Western view, you have some free will. They didn't speak in those terms, but it matters. It matters what you do. It's not all determined already. The future is not written already based on the past. All right, second view that the Buddha didn't agree with. Whatever a person experiences, all of that is caused by God's creative activity or by a God's whim. Some people believe this, even in modern society, but the Buddha says it's not true. It's not that there's some powerful external being whose whim decides what happens to us. That also would not really motivate us, would it, to walk the path? Why does it matter if it's all just determined by some more all-powerful being? And then the third one is that whatever we do, all of that, or whatever this person experiences, all of that occurs without a cause or condition. So it's random, who knows? Who knows what comes? It just comes. It comes. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you do. There's no real impact because it's all just kind of random. I'm hamming it up a little bit. But, there are parts of us that kind of believe some of these in some areas of our life. We can have a sense of this is a total disempowerment. It doesn't matter what you do because it doesn't have a cause or a condition. So the Buddha's precise about this. He says, actually, there are causes and conditions that have to come together for things to happen, but they're not predetermined. And you have an effect on those. You have some ability to influence those. It's not just determined by external beings. So you can start to see he triangulates around these other extreme views that would be quite demotivating and I think demoralizing if they were true. So the Buddha, however, didn't kind of just offer one more opinion and say, all those guys are wrong, I've got it right, you should listen to me because, I'm the Buddha, or something like that. he really wanted us to see for ourselves whether these things are true. So he offers teachings that we can actually check and find out and practice with and test. Although the thing about karma is it's pretty complicated and we can't completely test it. So, you know. But one thing that the Buddha did was that he would take existing ideas and then he would add surprising twists to them so that people were sort of jarred into awareness and they had to look, oh, right, I didn't realize I had that view until somebody, you know, poked at it a little bit. So the Buddha, in relation to kama or karma, he didn't just talk about action, but he talked about action and result, which is vipaka, is result. So kama vipaka, action and result. Actions have results. This matters more deeply maybe than it sounds at first, and it will unfold that as we go along, is that actions are consequential, and they unfold in particular ways that are lawful. So maybe this is a good time now to do a little aside and say, Buddhist teachers like me get frustrated with the use of the word karma in popular society because it is a word that a fair number of people have heard, not everybody, but a fair number of people have heard the word karma. It's now used in, you know, advertisements and marketing and, you know, news magazine articles. You'll see this word, but often it's not used in the way that it's used in Buddhist teachings. It's used something like fate. You know, it's your karma that this is happening to you, something like that, right? What's interesting is that, you know, we just learned that it's not all predetermined, you know, that the Buddha did not agree with that view. So it's not actually fateful. Karma, almost in direct contrast, karma is the choiceful action that we make. We have the karma is the choice that we have. And what's fateful is vipaka. You know, that is kind of unfolding from karma that is done. Not totally deterministically, but, you know, there are certain effects that have to come about once an action has been made. It has to unfold and ripen in certain ways with some nuance that we'll add in. So at a given moment, we have complexity in that there may be several things going on. So in a given moment, there's the vipaka arriving from the past. There was some action that was done that has to have a certain effect, and that might be ripening. And so there's that arriving. But in addition, we have fresh karma that we're generating right now in response to it, which we have some choice about. And then that is sending ripples forward into the future. So there's this mix of stuff that's arriving, that's just arriving, and choices that we have. When do we have choice? Now, this present moment. We can do something that affects then how future moments ripen. So you see the complexity and the sort of interacting nature of it, but there is this moment of choice in the present moment. And if you're not here for it, though, because you're distracted, you're not mindful, then you don't really have a choice. But mindfulness gives us that moment in this present moment where we can make a choice, can affect how things unfold going forward. So that was one thing that the Buddha did, is he talked about action and result and how they operate somewhat differently, but they're related. So that's one thing. And then the other thing, maybe the most important thing that the Buddha did around karma, his theory of action, was that he ethicized it. And he said, the result is in line with the wholesomeness or the unwholesomeness of the intention behind the action. So it sounds kind of straightforward when I say it that way. Like, of course, you know, if we do something good, it will have a good result. If we do something harmful, it will have a harmful result. But not everybody believed that, right? These other views, you know, it's random. It doesn't matter what you do. That's not an ethical view. It's all determined by God. That's not an ethical view unless you're sure about God's motivations. So he says we have choice and the choice matter. It matters whether we are ethical in our choices. This is built in to the structure of action. So we could say maybe that karma then is intentional action, and the quality of that intention affects the result. Just to give a simple, really practical example, let's say that a person takes a knife and cuts into another person. It matters tremendously if the intention was murder or surgery. Does it not? Yes. Yes. And the result on the person doing it is completely different. So a surgeon, is trying to help people, and not that they always do it perfectly, but that's a very different impact on that person's life than a person who is taking a knife to do some kind of crime or harm with it. Very different effect on the doer. So I'll read some lines from the Dhammapada that you have probably heard before, but maybe they now ring a little more deeply in light of what we're talking about. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. This is a teaching about karma. What action you do is dependent on the mind behind that action. The result will be in line with that, happiness or suffering. And the sutta says, speak or act with this kind of mind, but the suttas in general name three kinds of action: bodily, verbal, and mental. So even thinking is, if it's done intentionally, is an act, is a karmic act. So this is another area where we have to sometimes check our modern values, because we might have a subtle belief that if I just think it and I don't act on it, it's okay. Right? I can sit there in a meeting and be thinking, God, I hate my boss. Boy, that was a stupid comment. But I'm not saying any of it. I'm smiling. I'm just sitting there. Nope. This is a karmic act of hatred, and it will have an impact on you, on the doer of that act. So, hence, we see also maybe a deeper dimension to meditation practice, such that our mind gets cleaned up in addition to our speech and our actions. It's not just what comes out, although, of course, that has a big impact on others too, but even mental acts affect us. So let's pause for a moment. Do you agree with those first two lines of two stanzas of the Dhammapada that I read? Check it out in your own experience. And it's okay if your answer is, I'm not totally sure about that. Then that's something that we can check out in our own experience. You don't have to believe it. You don't have to believe it. Also, I don't know that we can check it out 100% because of this sort of complexity of the how karma unfolds, and we're interacting with other people's karma and so forth. I don't know that we can always exactly say, yes, speak or act with a corrupted mind and suffering follows. Maybe we see something where we think there might be an exception to that. Or, speak or act with a peaceful mind and happiness follows. Is that 100% true? I don't know that we could know. It's not. If it were that easy, everyone would understand karma and we wouldn't have these challenges and have to give Dharma talks about it and things like that. But I'll offer one other view that you can check out. Maybe it's less important whether this is actually 100% true than whether your life improves if you act as if it were true. Yeah. Yeah. So, implications for practice. Let's talk a little bit about practice. So, one thing that we can do is we can observe, based on these stanzas that I read, speak or act with a corrupted mind or a peaceful mind. We can check where is our mind when we're acting? Where is this action coming from? This is a very useful practice question, and you do it right in the moment. I'm about to speak. Where is it coming from? If we can just take a pause and notice that, there's a kind of a little acronym people use sometimes, which is WAIT, W-A-I-T. Some of you are nodding already. It stands for Why Am I Talking? Wait before you talk and check, why am I talking? So we can notice the what's called in the Dharma, it's called the root of where action is coming from. And there are six roots. There's the root of greed, of hatred, of delusion, and of non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. Those are kind of the six options. And, you know, again, maybe there's, do they really cover absolutely everything? I don't know, but that's a lot. A lot of things come from those six. So clarifying our intention, clarifying where we're coming from, is a really important part of practice. And it's very pragmatic. You can do it for yourself right in this moment. And you might be very interested to notice patterns of where things come from. And sometimes it's quite mixed. I'm not saying it's pure. You're always going to see it's exactly coming from greed or from non-hatred. Or it might be kind of, well, you know, I'm kind of being kind and generous, and I'm kind of hoping that this person's going to go into my debt and give me something back because I give them something. You know, these things can kind of get mixed together. But just check. One thing that will happen when we start doing this, we start trying to pay attention to the flow of actions, bodily, verbal, and mental in our life, is that we will notice that there's a lot of momentum behind doing things, compulsion. And we'll realize that things are tumbling along, that we didn't necessarily want to do it that way. But there's momentum there. There's habit that's operating around speaking and acting in certain ways. And so we have a practice challenge of making wise choices, even in the face of momentum. And it can be a real triumph when we know that we have a habit of doing something and we see it again and again. It's so painful. And then there's that one time where we get there in time and it doesn't happen that way. It can be feel like such a triumph. And if we're just living unmindfully, we don't have those moments. But, you know, the moment where we bite our tongue and we don't snap at our partner, or where we, you know, often it's where we restrain ourselves. We don't interrupt. You know, we realize we have a habit of interrupting, and then one day we don't do it. That's an important moment of freedom to notice. And so then I'll also point toward a teaching that the Buddha gave on the different courses of action based on action and result. And this is something, again, that's very pragmatic to start looking at. So he says it in the kind of formal language of the suttas, but he says there are these four courses of action. Which four? There's the course of action that is unpleasant to do and that when done leads to what is unprofitable. There's the course of action that is unpleasant to do, but when done, leads to what is profitable. There's the course of action that is pleasant, but when it's done, it leads to what's unprofitable. And the course of action that's pleasant, and when it's done, it leads to what is profitable. So this is a really important area to start noticing: the action, the intention, and then the action, and then the result, right? This sort of unfolding of different stages of the action. So there are things that we that are unpleasant to do and they have bad results. So that's easy. Those are the easy ones. And there are things that are pleasant to do and they have good results. Also very easy. But the ones in the middle, right? So he says, now, as for the course of action that is unpleasant to do, but when done, leads to what is profitable, it is in light of this course of action that one may be known as a wise person or a fool. For a fool does not reflect, even though this course of action is unpleasant to do, still it leads to what is profitable. So they don't do it and they don't get the profit. This profit, it means benefits or something good coming out of it. And it doesn't mean that doing harmful things leads to good. That wouldn't be in line with what the Dhammapada said. But this is, says what's unpleasant to do. So it may be unpleasant to hold your tongue when somebody is talking in opinions that you don't agree with at all. But doing so is beneficial. Not to get in that fight one more time is very beneficial, right? So it's unpleasant, maybe. And then the other way is, so there are things that we know that are pleasant. So pleasant and unpleasant are not the same as good and harmful, right? So there are things that are pleasant to do, but they lead to things that are not beneficial, like eating that third piece of cake. Might be pleasant in the moment, might not actually, but might be pleasant in the moment for the tongue, but it doesn't lead to a beneficial result for the belly 15 minutes later. So, you know, that's another area where, you know, if we're wise, we see, okay, this is pleasant, but I know it doesn't lead to a good result, a beneficial result, something that helps my path, my practice, my well-being. So I will choose not to do it, even though it's pleasant. So there's this sense of, this is what the ethics of behind these practices is to learn the difference between what is actually helpful and what is merely pleasant, and what is actually harmful and what is merely unpleasant. There's a difference between those, right? There's an ethical difference between those. So, interesting stuff. Another implication is that we don't really get away with anything. So, you know, if you're not found out for an action that you did that wasn't so good, it still had a karmic impact. Sometimes we believe if nobody saw, it's okay. But, you know, there's a story, I've told this story before, but I love it, of a teacher who told his students, go into the marketplace. This is a test for you, you know, with your advanced practice. Go into the marketplace and steal some small item such that, and bring it back without anybody seeing you. Do that. You should be able to do that. And so the students sneak off into the marketplace and they come back with, you know, a peanut that they slipped into their pocket from the bin of peanuts and things like that. One student comes back empty-handed and the teacher says, why did you bring nothing back? And the student says, you said we had to do it such that nobody saw, I would see. The teacher says, right? You would see it. You would still see it. Do you value your own vision of something so little that it doesn't count? Of course it counts. Maybe more. So, of course, as I also like to say, this works in the realm of good karma too, in the realm of happiness and the unfolding of beneficial effects. So just like you can't get away with anything harmful, it will still have its effects. You don't get away with anything beneficial either. It will definitely bring you happiness. You can't avoid the happiness from your good actions. It has to come. So, I mean, I'm saying that a little tongue in cheek, but sometimes people think ethics is all about the bad stuff and not doing things wrong. This is from some other spiritual tradition. In Buddhism, ethics is a great source of happiness, because it tells you how to do things such that you will be happy. Be generous, be kind, be loving, be restraining of harmful language. All of that is causes of happiness. It's delightful to see people from cultures that have a more cultural understanding of karma, like some of the Asian countries, at how joyful people are just to be given, for example, the opportunity to give. They're like, because they know it's going to bring so much happiness and they're so excited about it. So then I'll say a little bit also about, a little bit more about how karma ripens, since we've now kind of moved into that realm. We might assume, there are some assumptions that we tend to carry about the ripening of karma that may also not quite be in line with the Buddhist teachings. One is that we might think, okay, now I get it. I've got all this karma from the past and it's ripening. And somehow now that I'm on the path and I understand and I'm practicing mindfulness, so I'm in the present moment and have choices, my task is to cancel out all of the bad karma. that I've accumulated so far. There's a ledger book somewhere, and it's got a bunch of negatives on it that I know, and I've got to do as many positives between now and my death in order to cancel all of that out. This actually isn't true. It's not, the Buddha didn't see it that way. One reason is that, remember that in the Buddhist teachings, there's this understanding of rebirth. So you actually have many, many lifetimes of accumulated karma. You literally don't have time to cancel it all out. So that can't be how it works. In fact, the Buddha says there's no beginning point to our wandering on in samsara. You don't have to believe in rebirth to accept the teachings of karma, but they become more complete if you see a longer time scale. They become, I think, also a little bit more deeper and meaningful. So you can cancel it all out one for one. So forget about that idea. We might also, another thing that we carry from other traditions, often if we have a Abrahamic background, is that somehow the result would always be of the same intensity as the original act. So for a minor slip, there will be a minor result. For a major crime, there will be huge suffering. And broadly speaking, if we have no mindfulness and no development of our mind, that's broadly speaking true. But it's not true if we have the intervention of practicing. So this proportionality idea is not quite true. It turns out that if we're developing our mind, particularly through meditation, we mitigate the effects of unwholesome karma in major ways. The famous example is a teaching on the murderer Angulimala in the suttas, who is said to have killed some large number of people, 999. Probably it's a little mythological. But he then has a moment of reckoning, realizes this was a bad idea. He had actually been practicing in previous lifetimes and had been a very, very good yogi. And then he just had this one fall and did a bunch of murdering. And then the Buddha taught him, and he changed his mind, and he practiced very hard in the moment, and he became an arahant. He became fully awakened. But he still had done these crimes, even in this lifetime. And so there was a result of it, which is that when he went on alms round, people threw rocks at him and potsherds, and it cut his head. And he came back bleeding. And the Buddha said, bear it. Just bear that cut on your head. That is the effect that you're getting of these murders. If you hadn't been fully awakened, however, you would have had huge suffering. You would have had to go into the lower realms and live for a long time with a lot of pain and so forth. So there's an analogy given that a person who is developed in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom, who is unlimited and has a lofty character and dwells without measure, such a person feels the effects of bad karma immediately and to a small degree. So you don't get this huge impact, and you also don't get a delayed impact. And this is what we want. We want to feel the karma right away. If we do something, you get the feedback. It's like training an animal. You know, you give the feedback right away. You can't really do it the next day, or it doesn't quite take, right? So we want to get the immediate feedback, and also mitigated through mindfulness and through having an ethical character. So the kind of, you know, if you don't believe the whole Angulimala story, the analogy given instead is a cup of water. So if I take a cup of water like this, and I put salt, a lump of salt in it, it will become undrinkable because there's so little water. It'll just become very, very salty. But if I throw that same amount of salt into a lake, a clear lake, it has no impact on the fresh water. And that's the difference between having a developed body and mind. You have a vast lake available inside. Some little minor slip or minor ripening of karma from the past, which we all have until forever, it just doesn't have that much impact. Whereas if you are living in a way that's unethical, that's unmindful, that's bringing harm, etc., then salt goes into this and it's a much bigger effect. Yep, not salty. So maybe a modern example that we could relate to is, I think many of us have had the experience where we've lied in some way. I know everyone has not always told the truth 100% in your life. And we've probably sometime in our life gotten into that situation where we've said something that wasn't true, and then we had to cover it up, and then we had to cover that up, and then we had to remember who we had told what in order to keep it all together. This is a lot of dukkha, besides the whatever impact from the lie itself. Whereas you've probably also had the experience of saying something untrue, realizing that, not wanting to go down that whole path, and just going and telling someone, you know what, this actually isn't, it isn't actually like that. This is how it really is. Or, you know, I'm not going to cover this up. This is what happened. And it's better, right? It's better. Maybe there's an impact in that moment or whatever, but you work through it. Way better than if you tried to cover it all up and then have more and more. So that's the same thing. You know, that's the same thing, is that you compound it by continuing it on, covering it over, having poor intentions around it. It just gets worse. So maybe that's a good introduction to the principles of karma and how they're pretty clearly laid out in the Dharma teachings. You know, actions have this result in line with the ethical quality of the intention, but then all the little ways in which we don't quite believe that in our mind. We sort of secretly believe, it doesn't matter, or we secretly believe that it's a linear effect or a proportional effect or something like that, or that our, if we see it, it doesn't matter. You know, so check in your mind, are there little ways in which you're not actually quite in line with the unfolding that's described here? And I can say that if we try to live more in line with how the karmic teachings are in the Pali Canon, I've found that my life just works much better. And so I have a lot of confidence that the Buddha got the theory of action, of how it works, closer to reality than those other views that we've named. But still, we have to look in the mind, you know, where am I cutting corners? Where am I not quite believing that? Where are my actions obviously not in line with the ripening of good effects in my life? And then working with that, that provides us right in the moment with, here's how we can work with this. So